Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Neuropsychotherapist, and I'm here with our managing editor, Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
Hi there, Matt. How are you going today?
Yeah, doing well, doing well. Well, today we've got a very interesting chap from California, and he is going to be talking to us about working with parents and children together. A very interesting interview that we've had with him. But before we dive into that interview, I want to just let you know that we're being sponsored today by the International Association of Applied Neuroscience, and they have their first International Conference of Applied Neuroscience in Sydney, Australia, from the 22nd to the 24th of May this year, and John Arden, our good friend John Arden, is presenting there as their keynote, and he's also doing a pre-conference workshop on the 21st. So we would encourage you to get along if you can. Now, Richard, Teddy Valise, a relational and developmental neurotherapeutic consulting coach, that's a mouthful, isn't it? And a licensed marriage and family therapist, we all know what that is, and a certified applied neuroscience professional and a certified resilience coach. So he's done an awful lot. He's also, we'll talk about it in the show, but he's got a bit of a different background as well from a different discipline.
Yeah, and this really interesting protocol that he's going to talk to us about. Fantastic.
Yeah, so why don't we dive in?
Dive in indeed.
Teddy Valise, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great, Matt.
And you are coming to us from California, is that right?
That's right, the Silicon Valley.
Oh, wow, where all the technical people are.
Yes.
Yes, and hello from me, Teddy, Richard here. Loving to have you here and talking about all kinds of things that absolutely fascinate me. So I hope they fascinate everybody else, where this is going to be really interesting.
Yes. Now, you have a wonderful protocol that we want to dive into. But before we get there, I'd love to know a little bit about your background, because you started somewhere quite different than psychotherapy, didn't you? Give us a little bit of a background of where you've come from.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I was a very curious kid when I was growing up, and I wasn't the typical kid that would be kind of focused on playing and building like the typical boy. I was very inquisitive. And so when I was around 15, I found all these books about positive thinking and psychology, and took a class as a senior in high school that taught us about the unconscious and mechanisms of defense. So I was fascinated with psychology for a long time, but at the time I felt that I had to be either an engineer or a doctor. So I chose the engineering route, went to university, got my degree in mechanical engineering, and then I got an MBA in finance.
Oh, wow.
And then once I kind of did that work, it's almost like there's a difference, I think, between a job and a vocation or passion. I realized that I had to go back to psychology. So it was just a matter of time. And a lot of my friends, by the time I got to psychology, they're like, duh, I'm surprised it took me so long.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then from psychology, you've obviously taken a particular route in psychology where you have this great interest in neurobiology and neuroscience.
Yeah. You know, I got really lucky that the university that I went to, the teachers that I got connected with were very attachment focused. And even though I was very logical and kind of like the typical technical analyst MBA type, something resonated. It wasn't what I was expecting. I really wanted to work with executives and mostly be kind of like a motivational speaker, really, initially. Okay. But yeah, the baby research, it really stuck, hit me in a way that I wasn't expecting. And from there, I found Dan Siegel and Alan Shore and all that work. And I think I'm comfortable with science, comfortable with technical stuff. I just ended up in this fascinating world of the brain, really. And it's almost like I couldn't go back. I was searching for etiology, for conceptualization, for where is this really happening in the brain? And that's not really the way that we were being trained when I was getting my clinical training.
Right.
It's quite fascinating. And here's our first connection is Dan Siegel, interpersonal neurobiology. I'm actually president of the Global Association of Interpersonal Neurobiology Studies, but exactly the same thing. Strangely, my background was as an actor coming into neuroscience, because it was like, how the hell does this work, particularly language? And so I came in through linguistics. But this fascination with the humanity, I would suggest that this actually speaks to something of you as a human being, which I think is a beautiful comment, that despite that there was this money opportunity here and this technical opportunity there, actually you wanted to chase the human being.
Yeah, you know, it just happened, and I wasn't, I ended up working in this very low income, you know, when you do clinical work, that's where people are needed. You know, you pretty much work for free as you're doing your training. And since I spoke Spanish, I ended up working with immigrant families in, you know, places that I probably would have never gone to. And so here I am going down the street with shorts and a t-shirt, completely just being blending in, you know, and that was, and almost doing like social work kind of stuff, because I had to take people to the, you know, the parents to the doctors because they didn't have somebody to take them and they were going to have surgery. I had to advocate so that people wouldn't get kicked out of their apartments. I mean, all of this stuff, I wasn't trained like that. And I came from a, you know, middle class background. So, it's almost like I found myself in a world or living something that I didn't know I had inside of me.
Mm. Which is very different, isn't it, to the academic and technical world of engineering. And when you started telling me this story, you know, I imagined that the usual trajectory would then to go and be a researcher, you know, and be just surrounded by books and research, because, you know, that sounds like a more, you know, technical academic sort of trajectory from engineering, for example. But no, you've chosen to dive deep into the messy world of humanity and be a clinician.
Absolutely. And I actually had an option when I, you know, I did a master's level clinical training, and I thought about doing the PhD instead. But as you said, sometimes PhDs can be very, at least in the US, the best PhD programs in clinical psychology, they're called clinical science, and they're very, very, they're all about research. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be a researcher. I've been there and I've done that. I wanted to perhaps explore more the kind of like the human aspect of the emotional aspect that at the time was really shut down in myself and I had no idea. I made the decision I wanted to be a clinician, and I wanted to try to get as much clinical training with that master's level, and perhaps I'll pursue a PhD program later on.
Okay.
But having said all that about moving away from the engineering and moving to this, which is very beautiful and very true, when I look at the protocol and when I look at the way you've put this together, it's actually constructed really in a very methodical and observably reasonable sort of way of doing things. So it's, where did you start to put the pieces together? Because you say you were looking at what was happening in the brain, where it was going, but then you were looking at what was doing, and you started to put these pieces together into some kind of dually informing sort of frame. Is that the sort of, am I on the right picture, on the right frame here?
Yeah, you know, Richard, I'm glad that you brought that up, because even though I'm a therapist, it's the engineer in me and the analyst in me is there. And yeah. I think that perhaps gives me this kind of like, because I, you know, my clients tell me like, Teddy, you know, I've gone to a lot of therapists and you're kind of like, one told me you're kind of like a different beast. In the way that I perhaps work. And I think that's the engineer, that's the technical part. So yeah, you're kind of noticing there, you know, I go to conferences and I make notes and I will follow up with the presenters. And, you know, if I find an article that I like, I will call them, I will send them emails. I do that. I'm kind of like a nerdy, I don't know, student almost. And I like that, you know?
You're a deep diver.
Where things came from.
Yeah. No, I can see that in your work. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to just take what somebody tells me. I'm going to pester them until I understand it.
So we better dive in to this parent-child neuropsychotherapy protocol. Maybe just a little bit of a global view of what is this protocol all about?
Yeah, so I got my training working with children, and the program that I worked for, even though it was a children and families program, we only saw the child. Yeah, we met with the parent. But I started to realize that my relationship with the child once a week or twice a week for an hour a week, a week or 2 or 3 hours a week, wasn't going to be enough if there was turmoil at home. Mm-hmm. Not because parents wanted it to be that way, but because in a nutshell, I thought that the ones that really needed my 1 hour a week or 2 hours a week were the parents, so that they can then make that time and multiply it and turn it into 5, 6, 10, 20 hours a week of brain-based therapeutic interventions with the children. Mm. This is kind of maximizing, automize, becoming very efficient, effective with time. That's the engineer in me. And so I started to, instead of working with the child, work with the parents, which is something that we were not supposed to do, but I did it anyways. And my supervisors could see the difference, because the relationship was not with me. They would be great with me, but they didn't live with me. And so, even though it's a child, parent-child protocol, in essence, I work with everybody in the family. Mm. And most of my clients will come to me because a child is having problems. But because I hardly work one-on-one with the child, unless it's a teenager that has risky behavior, I start meeting with the parents for coaching. And pretty soon I'm doing individual with each parent and then couples. And then I pepper it with parenting intervention. So I really do the entire family.
A real systems perspective there.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, everybody who listens to us knows that complex systems are what we try and encourage people to understand is the way life works. And, I'm sort of sitting here saying, oh, great, you get the parents and you change the initial conditions, you alter the framework and so on and so forth. But it also makes me think of, although it's different, but Whitaker and family systems, did that inform you at all? Or was that just something that was interesting on the side? Or
yeah, so the professor, I had a professor that was Winnicottian. Michael Axelman, one of my professors in my clinical program, and he had that family systems, psychodynamic approach, and he just pretty much kind of taught me, you know, a child is nobody without his or her mother, you know, and so you kind of, I didn't have like an amazing family systems class. It was more about this professor and the coaching that I got from him, the clinical supervision that I got from him. And if you really think about it, all clinicians complain about the family, but it's really difficult, I tell you, to really engage the parents because they feel like they're going to be blamed or judged. So that is an art that I think I've been able to, it's almost like a slow dance that I do with them. But I make them feel very comfortable.
And this is one of the things where I'm looking at the work and seeing how you've brought your own particular framework to that. Because, of course, Whitaker would have everybody in the room. He says, you bring everybody. I want uncle, aunties, and cousins and grandmothers. And that was a ball game. But it was a different ball game to this idea that you find that I actually can work individually, bring couples. So you sort of differentiate the system in a really beautiful way, and I'm suspecting that what that does is it eases the amount of potential embarrassment or shame or guilt that can come up when everybody's in the room. They can be a little bit more open about some of the stuff.
Exactly, and you know, I have very much respect for this little part of our brain called the amygdala. And if that little creature gets dysregulated, then nothing is going to work. And when you have adults and kids in the room, even the language that they're speaking, there's different themes in there that might not pertain to the children. But most importantly, I'm all about one-on-one relationships. And even with couples, when I do work with couples, most of my work I do with them individually. And then I bring them in together, almost kind of like to pass the test, so to speak. But most of the work I'm doing coaching them individually. And then they do their work, whatever I coach them individually, then they do it at home. But it's not a homework, because my sense is that usually when couples therapists give couples homework, they don't do it. But the way that I work with them, they do it because it's not a homework. It's almost like they're understanding themselves in a way that they didn't understand themselves. And they're realizing that they're can be as hurt as their partner. And they eventually they realize that even though they might think that I have these two little Australian porcupines I bought in Australia at one point. I don't know what you call them, those creatures. They're kind of weird looking.
Yeah, the echidna.
Those things, yes. Glass things. And, you know, and I tell them, you know, like you get together and you poke one another and you don't realize that even you will blame one another for the poking, but in reality, the pain comes from an unresolved wound from the past and you both are victims. So I'm going to help you to help each other.
Yeah.
To heal another. So it's a very collaborative, you know, there's not an enemy here. No, I don't single anybody out. It's more of like, you're going to help one another. Perhaps you didn't get a secure attachment when you were little, but now it's your opportunity to do it. And I'm going to work with each one of you so that you can help one another.
And I know you've got something, Matt, but I'll just jump in because I want to just highlight what I think is really important in there, which people may or may not have got, but that use, Teddy, of the word realize as different from teach, or as you say, homework, as in direct, and bringing this thing. So when they realize, it's a self, and this of course fits in my mind, you know, client responsive, that the client is just lovely. So that's an important word.
And perhaps another way to say that is that the approach is bottoms up instead of top down. And that is really because it's they're intrinsically motivated to do this. It comes from within. And I tell them, I'm going to get under your skin. I'm not going to get in your cortex and tell you to do stuff. I'm going to get under your skin and, you know, in your gut and rattle in there. And I'm going to be a catalyst between the two of you. I'm just very upfront about it. And that's where like the engineering me comes in.
And the Spanish, yes.
In a very relational way, you know, and funny way, because I can do that too.
So, Teddy, you talk about something called relational neuronarrative. Tell us a little bit, what is that about?
Yeah, so this is, so a little background. So early in life, things happen and our brain starts to take in information, starts creating some sort of map as to how the world is going to be, and we adapt to survive in that world. I call that the primitive narrative. Usually that primitive narrative, because it's mostly driven by that fight or flight amygdala, I need to survive, I need to be safe, it's very negative. If older brother gets something and I don't get something, then you must love Johnny more than you love me. And if Mikey starts playing with Susie and not playing with me, then I must be dumb. This stuff is so pervasive. And so the relational neuronarrative is an attempt for the parent to use a behavior, usually a bad behavior, and frame it, try to help the child understand where that behavior might come from. So I'll give you an example. Let's just say that the kid comes home with a black eye, got into a fight, you know, maybe an eight-year-old. Most parents would go into attack mode. Why did you do this? You can't do that. You're grounded. The relational neuronarrative would sound like this. Wow, you had a bad day today. You got in trouble. How was that for you? You know, it's possible that you must be, that you might be upset because we've been spending a lot of time with your younger sister. You know, she's been having some medical problems. And if that's true, maybe you're angry or maybe you're sad. And that might have caused you to get into a fight. So as you can hear there, there's a lot of maybe, might have. And what you're doing there is that you're helping the child make sense of what just happened. Another way of saying that, you're trying to help the child make connections between thoughts, behaviors, and emotions instead of going into this correct mode. So there is a chapter that has been beautifully written by Dan Hughes in one of his books. It's called Connect Instead of Correct. And most parents go into correct mode. And right there, when you have a kid with a black eye, what you, the most important thing, if you have the future in mind, is to help the child understand what happened. And to help the child process their own emotions behind that. Wow, you have a brown eye, a black eye. Maybe that was embarrassing. And what you want is for the child to talk to you. Yes, this happened and I was mad. A lot of children will freeze, will not talk, and then you can't really engage. So it's all about the relationship.
Yeah, and I was thinking that while you're giving these possibilities, this just resonates so much with the work I do as well, which it should because it's natural and this is what human being, but it gives the opportunity for the child to then come in. So when you gave the initial sort of just example for us, the parent was doing all the talking, but I could hear in between those, the child would jump in and say, oh no, it's not my little sister that's bothering, the time with my little sister is bothering me. It's the time you're spending with whatever. Yeah. And it gives the child the opportunity to actually even correct the parent. If the parent is not saying, I know what you've done and you're this, sort of like, hey, have I been doing this? Have you been doing that? Curiosity. Well, everybody knows where I am with that.
And a lot of times, you know, what happens, it's fascinating, is that when parents start to do this, parents that used to be very consequence-driven, and I would tell them, please just suspend the consequences until you understand my protocol, because you'll find out that you won't need it. The kids will put themselves in timeout.
Yeah, I've heard that.
They did wrong. So the shame is already there. And so what happens when you give them the consequence without helping them process, you have all these emotions that are kind of bottled up inside. And this is what turns, these things accumulate. And eventually when they become teenagers, it comes out roaring, you know? And then parents usually don't know where it came from. He was fine. He was excellent. When we start digging, he was never fine. And by the way, I apologize. I use a lot of male pronouns. Most of my kids are boys because I'm a male therapist. I do work with girls, but you know, and there's also kind of like a personal thing here, like all of us therapists, that you know, my parents didn't have the sophistication to know this kind of stuff. So there's always little Teddy in all of this, you know. I just want to for the listeners.
Yeah, no, that's very good. I'm glad you brought that up because it's something that we do naturally talk about those people we tend to see more often. And it isn't unusual for men to see, tend to see males. I'm surprised at how many females that I do see when they come along and they actually want to have that, see a male who's not doing what dad did, or I suppose is some of the things. I'm a bit older than you. But so now when we go that, Matt, where do you want to see this move? Because this is interesting
stuff. Just keeping
stuff,
an eye on the time here. And I'm just wondering, Teddy, is there somewhere we can, you know, sort of land here for the moment? And I'd love to have you back on the show to go a little deeper into this protocol, because I understand you've got a number of phases that you step through. And maybe we could do a show just on the real practicalities of what this protocol is all about. Would that be okay?
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
So I'm just thinking between now and then, in this week, is there a place that our listeners can go in to check you out? As you say, they're doing the check. If you've got some website or some papers, or what would you suggest for them to explore you in between to check you out?
I have a website. It's my first name and last name, teddyvalise.com. Yep. And I don't know if you guys have some sort of notes for the...
Oh, yes. We'll make sure everybody knows. Yeah.
Maybe we can include that in there. And it's a pretty comprehensive website.
Oh, brilliant. Well, that's where I'm going, Matt. I'm going to go and check him out. So when we see him next week, I'll have some good questions.
Teddy, thank you so much for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we'll look forward to catching you again next week. And we'll continue this conversation.
Sounds great. Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye for now. Okay, Matt, that was great. No, we need to talk to him again.
We do, yes.
So we'll grab him as soon as we can, and we'll get him on next week, I think, because I want to go a bit deeper into the protocol, some of the, what he called the stages, and also some of this more, just slightly more academic work and more deeper understanding of the brain and the genes as well, which is really important. Mm-hmm. So that'd be great. So we'll see him again.
All right, looking forward to that. So thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. Now, if you would like to leave a rating and some comments for this podcast on iTunes, that would be fantastic. Please do that. That would help us a lot. And if you are really interested in the science behind psychotherapy, then come and join us at thescienceofpsychotherapy.com. Become a member. You know, get into all of the content that we have there. We've been going since 2013, so we've got quite a bit of content for you.
Yes, and of course, as managing editor of our flagship magazine, The Neuropsychotherapist, I am always keen to see articles where you're talking about something, perhaps, which is an idea, but also just neuropsychotherapy in practice. How do you practice utilizing the neuroscience knowledge? How does that inform your practice and create a better process? Please feel free to write to me with something and we'll see what we can do.
That's right, because we're a community.
Aren't we? Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Looking forward to talking to you and to Teddy again next week.
Yes, and check out in the show notes all the stuff to connect with what Teddy's doing. Check him out.
Beautiful.
Bye for now.
See you later.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.